fish in the sea? Can we undo the damage before they're all gone?
Are we killing ocean life?
What would it take to be the granddaddy of fisheries researchers? On-site experience in many places, 500 papers published, working with a dedicated team and with other top scientists all over the world.
I wish I was a fisherman.
Then what if that top scientist sees and can now prove that humans are killing off their own food fisheries and creating giant deserts on the bottom of the sea? Now you understand the predicament of Dr. Daniel Pauly, director of the well-respected Fisheries Center at the University of British Columbia. He's almost a global citizen, French national, raised in Europe, worked decades in the Far East, studying the fisheries from his base in the Philippines. In 1994, he accepts the post leading a dedicated research team on Canada's Pacific coast. This is a man and an institution that asks the big, tough questions. How do fish catches compare to those of the early 1900s? Are marine mammals a danger to fish stocks? Where do developed countries get fish for restaurants and their home tables once their own fish stocks have crashed? Are we killing off the world's fisheries?
Should I care?
Canada knows this situation very well after its 500-year-old cod fishery collapsed in 1990 and hasn't come back. Is that an isolated incident? To find out, the Paulian researchers gathered catch data collected by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO. Along with other scientists, they soon realized that while specific FAO information was very valuable, the total catches being reported were larger than life. Pauly says that China has been exaggerating fish catch reports, as they exaggerate wheat harvests and other production statistics to reflect the success of the state. The FAO said the overall world catch was going up. Dr. Pauly and a chorus of independent fisheries scientists said the global ocean harvest is actually declining. The catch is dropping despite bigger, faster boats, going much further, burning more fuel than ever before. Even satellite and sonar gear cannot increase the catch. Europe has exhausted many species in the North Sea and must now go down to the coast of Africa to feed the European diet of fish, including the mandatory Friday seafood meal sanctioned by the church. We will hear about trawlers creating new deserts hidden at the bottom of the sea. Dr. Pauly explores the possibilities and problems of aquaculture, which he concludes cannot save us. Even eating seafood using a green guide may not be enough to preserve enough edible species for our grandchildren. On the East Coast, Dr. Boris Worm has predicted the fisheries will crash globally by 2048. But where does that date come from, and what do these scientists really know? Welcome to the first part of Killing Off the Oceans, an ongoing series on our impact on ocean life. Will we really force up to 90% of ocean species into extinction? Is that possible? From overfishing or due to carbon pollution turning the seas acidic? You can download this program and the rest of the series free from Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. Just look for Oceans in the Audio On Demand menu. I'm your host, Alex Smith. This week, we'll be working with a speech made by Dr. Daniel Pauly at UBC in Vancouver, March 10, 2007. It was part of the top-rated Vancouver Institute series. To study the state of world fisheries, scientists begin with reported catches, locations, and a mountain of other data to place each fishery on a kind of curve. If the fishery is very new, relatively untouched, it is labeled undeveloped. When the catch reaches 50% of the possible, it is called developing. At the peak, when the most fish possible are being caught, that is, fully exploited. Usually, after the peak, an overexploited fishery, there is a sharp, sharp drop to the final state, crashed. Using computers, it is possible to calculate each fishery and merge all those curves into a general pattern for Earth. When this was done, the results showed there were hardly any fully exploited fisheries in 1950, and none had crashed. By the 1980s, a majority of fisheries were fully exploited, and some had crashed. By 2000, there were almost as many crashed fisheries as exploited ones. In eastern Canada, Dr. Worm used this data and fed it into a computer model which showed a global crash somewhere around 2048. That was a wake-up call for the public and the politicians, but little action has followed. In fact, as we'll see, governments have become part of the problem, prolonging fisheries beyond their real lifespans by paying off the fish industry with billions of dollars in subsidies. Likely, that includes your own government. Actually, the figure 2048 was not in the scientific paper, but appeared in the press release and subsequent reports. It caused a controversy. Dr. Worm's model created a projection which assumed we go on fishing as now. If humans fail to change their fishing practices and rein in the excessive fleet, but no one can predict the future. Perhaps you and I will act in time. Dr. Pauly gives concrete suggestions of how we can change, and this is why he accepts the state of gloom about world fisheries, but not yet the sense of doom. Meanwhile, the press attacked the 2048 figure rather than realizing the imminent threat.
Certainly, it says, if we continue the way we are, things will happen that we don't like, and that is certainly true. So, while this date has been criticized by lots of colleagues, scientists and non-scientists, the trend has not been noted. And that's similar to a quotation I was using once. It says, look at where my finger is pointing, don't bite it. Don't bite the finger, look where it's pointing. And this is essentially what happened here. They bit the finger instead of looking where it's pointing.
Pauly's Sea Around Us project maps out where humans fish. The richest fisheries are on the continental shelf areas. That is where we can catch enough to pay for the fuel, the fishers, the boat, and allegedly a profit. There are some fish in the open ocean, but they are so dispersed it is not economical to catch them. The open ocean contains 10 times fewer fish per square kilometer than nearer the shore. Most of the world's ocean wealth hugs the coastlines. China is a big concern in all this. The billion Chinese love their seafood and count on it for protein. The government must always announce success, but Dr. Pauly finds their catch is decreasing.
And there was China, and that story, you might have heard it or not, that story was that we could show that the Chinese catch were exaggerated, and we calculated the catch that were actually true. And the result of this is that we could document that the world fisheries catch was actually not increasing as FAO and official documents were stating, but actually decreasing.
Here's another pitfall. The FAO has been reporting an increase in fish catches, but that is because they add aquaculture to the total. The real ocean catch is declining steadily at an alarming rate, Pauly's team has found.
In other words, since the 1980s, capture fisheries of the world are declining in spite of the considerable fishing effort that we are doing. And every 2 years, the FAO publish the state of the world fisheries and aquaculture. And I looked at it 2 years ago, 2 days ago, and the latest, the declining trends has continued, but the FAO doesn't report that. It always reports total fisheries catches with aquaculture together, and that goes up. So the press, which reported on the FAO press release, reported fisheries catches are going up. Actually, fishing catches are going down, but aquaculture plus fisheries are going up. But the FAO published the result with and without China now, because they have to acknowledge the fact that China overreports. And
the FAO didn't count bycatch, more than 30 million tons of sea life wasted annually, tossed overboard as non-target species, dead. But now more of that is being kept and counted as catch tonnage to be fed to other fish in aquaculture. That addition also hides the real decline in species that humans like to eat. And the catch effort is increasing all the time. Ships have to go much further, perhaps thousands of miles, burning up low-grade diesel fuel, spewing out tons of carbon and pollution. The scientists can measure the biomass of the fish, the number of fish per square kilometer or mile, and the biomass is dropping rapidly. Pauly shows this decline compared to 1900 and 1950 on his slides. As Europe fished out its own waters, they moved to West Africa. They were joined there by the Russians and Asians. corrupt and failed states were easily bought out and bribed. Some, like Angola, were fighting civil wars. As a result, while Africans went hungry, their fish went to European dinner tables as a healthy alternative to other meat. Local people starved because they could not afford to buy fish from just offshore, and some were forbidden to fish as well. Dr. Pauly compares this to the Irish potato famine in the 1840s when Ireland was exporting wheat as millions starved. The African countries get very little for their fishing rights. Almost all the value goes to Europe, Russia, or the Far East. The same rapid decline of overexploited fish is now happening off the coast of Africa and is shocking to see in East Asia. There is one glaring exception. The billionaire Sultan of Brunei, an absolute monarch, doesn't want fishing boats around his offshore oil platforms, so the Sultanate has become one of the few fish preserves in the region. It works. Fish are plentiful there, while wiped out in neighboring countries. Next, Pauly investigates the emotional question of whether marine mammals are to blame for falling fish stocks.
There is no fish. Can we blame the marine mammal? When we have a problem, we go elsewhere because we don't need to solve it, and we can go elsewhere and catch fish. Another thing we can do is blame the marine mammals. And there is one country or more that actually spend lots of energy blaming the marine mammals. And they are eating a lots of fish, actually. Marine mammal, together, about 115 species, consume about 400 to 500 million tons of things. That's a lot. That's about 3-4 times what we eat, what we consume from the sea. And if we count all illegal fishing and so on.
Should we kill off whales, seals, and dolphins to protect the fisheries? After all, marine mammals do eat more than the total human catch. Scientists have calculated their populations and mapped out where these wild creatures overlap with important human fisheries. That overlap is high in Europe and in East Asia, and consequently there is more pressure from the fishing industry in those areas. Some fishermen demand a cull, a killing of marine mammals to leave more fish for humans to scoop out of the sea.
Canada, Newfoundland will be there bashing some seals and making the seal responsible for the collapse of the cod. You know, actually, Canada makes about $40 million on these seals, selling the pelt. And every year it loses $200 million for tourists that are outraged and don't come. $160 million loss. Anyway, you put these things together, and what you see is that the marine mammals consume their food mainly in areas of no overlap, of little overlap. And we have a situation where we could basically kill all marine mammals on Earth, and it would not make much difference to the decline of fisheries. And this is actually what we are dealing with in the International Whaling Commission and so on. Right now there is a tamper, Japan, supported by some countries in Europe, to reopen whaling. It has no basis whatsoever, but the sad thing is that lots of countries, developing countries, are made to vote with Japan by arguments. One of them is bribe and so on, but the other one is the argument, you will have more fish if you help us. But actually, they could zap all the marine mammals in the world and they wouldn't catch more.
We learn that humans start with the largest fish, such as the giant tuna, predators that live at the top of the food web. As these disappear, as tuna are now disappearing, we go down the food chain to hunt their food. We catch juvenile fish, crashing the larger species, and the smaller fish that they were feeding on. Our worst practice in the sea is certainly trawling, otherwise known as bottom dragging. Huge weights and rollers cause a net to scrape up everything on the seafloor and haul it to the surface. Most of it is then tossed overboard, lifeless. In this speech, Dr. Pauly stressed a small but very important concept. In the ocean, microscopic algae are the staple of the sea. The heavy rollers and net create a muddy wake of turbid water, which Pauly compares to the contrails of jets. In the lecture, he showed, for the first time, photos taken from space showing the muddy contrails of trawlers deep under the sea. One startling slide showed long lines of Chinese trawlers dragging the China Sea side by side. It looked like 1,000 tractors plowing up the Great Plains. Nothing will be left there. What will the Chinese people do? We can expect the launch of a new international Chinese fishing fleet, burning still more carbon-laced fuel to take fish from the far corners of the world, just as the Europeans and Russians do already.
In the process, because we often, usually, use trawlers and other habitat-modifying gear, we wipe out the bottom of the ocean. Now, these beautiful little things here are not plants. They're animals that eat the plankton that falls at the bottom of the sea and firm up the bottom of the sea. And this is wiped out by trawling. And at the end of this trawling, you have essentially the mud flat. How much of this transformation is happening is actually, we don't imagine how strong this effect is. In 75, I was a young man dashing and in Indonesia, and we were fishing in a place where it was a development project. We're developing the trawl fisheries. And what we were catching was not fish. Mainly, we were catching this. And we were transforming a landscape, a seascape, that consisted of these things into a seascape that was consisting of these things, because that's good for shrimp. And that is not good for shrimp. So the sea, it was specifically the Java Sea, was utterly transformed. The big fish disappeared. The bottom vegetation, the bottom animals disappeared. And it was transformed into the big mud bed. This transformation is now occurring in most parts of the world. And this has lots of implications. One implication is that you get lots of jellyfish, because when you get this resuspension of turbid water, resuspension of sediment, turbid water, the condition of the environment here are very different from here, where you have the environment dominated by large fish, the water is clear, and the bottom is firm. Oops. And now comes two pictures that nobody has ever seen, that were the highlight of, that are the highlights for me of this presentation. They were communicated to me by a young man from Duke University who has discovered that trawlers have crumb trail. You know crumb trails behind the planes? We can see planes in the sky because we see the crumb trail. Well, he discovered that satellite picture have, if you apply the right filters to them, show crumb trail. This is incredible. It's like a dance. It's like a field. It's the sea. And this is all mud that is teared up from the bottom. Needless to say, a thing like that is not a natural habitat. Is nothing but a field. The forest is destroyed. And in a field, you get other things than in a forest. And one of the things you get is jellyfish. Now, jellyfish, we eat them. So that's OK. You don't eat them? Well, you will have to, because it's...
When the process of taking everything in the sea is complete, and the algae control animals are gone, the result is deadly algae blooms followed by long-lasting dead zones. Dead zones are popping up all over, and Pauly thinks trawling is a major contributing factor.
Another thing that you see the first two pictures of contrail of trawlers that we saw were actually from Texas, which is here. Now, they have lots of those things in the coast of Louisiana, and Alabama here, and they have dead zones. Dead zones is the process of fishing down has been concluded. There are no animals, there are no at the bottom that can pick up the excessive growth of plankton and consume it and make it harmless. So that stuff rots on the bottom, eats up all the oxygen, no more oxygen, everything dies. And dead zones are all over the place and increasing in the world. There are dead zones in Europe, there are dead zones in North America, and the first dead zone in this region has come up in Oregon. Yeah, I think you have read, if you have read the newspaper about 1 year ago, they have come. It's being attributed obviously to the climate and to the environment, but actually the removal of animals that offered a buffering capacity is probably a factor. It is clear that this dead zone is connected with the Mississippi, which brings lots of fertilizer from the Mississippi. But the bloom that the fertilizers induce, they would be eaten up, in part at least, by the bottom animals. But they're gone because of these trawlers.
Meanwhile, you, the consumer, don't really notice the tragedy playing out on the ocean because fish keeps showing up at the supermarket. Hardly any of it is local anymore. Those stocks are gone. No one asks where seafood comes from, how far away, who went hungry while you could afford more. And here is another problem. If you follow a green guide to sustainable fish, you may not avert a global crash in the fisheries.
Now, what we can do then is eat right. And have my student here who writes such beautiful things as what we should eat and why we should eat this. I'm presenting this slide just as a defense mechanism, because at least in the US, maybe not in Canada, but in the US, people always ask me, what should they eat? Then, the situation being what it is. And I said, oh, Jennifer has an answer. This is just to say that eating the right fish is something that we should do. Like we should not put our garbage on the street. Like we should switch off the light when we get out of a room. But this is not going to resolve our problem. Switching off the light that when we get out of the room is not going to solve our problem with global warming. And similarly, eating the right thing is, I've compared it with indulgences. It makes us feel good. It actually might work, but really the real reason we do it is because we want to have the impression that we do something, and whether we do something or not is questionable.
But there are some things we can do.
We can conclude some intermediate things. For example, it's not the whales, but we know that. And we need marine protected areas where these nasty things don't happen, because we're messing up everywhere we go. So we need marine protected area. Just like we need Stanley Park to have nice trees. If we allowed people to have chainsaws everywhere they go, we wouldn't have no Stanley Park. We must address overcapacity, and overcapacity, too many boats, has lots of causes. One of them is that the fisheries reserve subsidies. And we must favor small-scale fisheries against large-scale fisheries. And finally, we must make better use of the fish we catch. And because I'm going to say the things we can do, I'm not going to be into gloom and doom.
Meanwhile, marine protected areas, which we desperately need, are growing slowly around the world. Only 0.6% of the ocean is protected. And at the rate we're going, we will miss all the conservation targets.
We'll miss all targets. For example, the Convention on Biological Diversity says we should have 10% of the exclusive economic zone of countries by 2010. And 10% of the world ocean by 2010 also. Well, we will reach that goal in 2060. The World Park Conference, we should have 20% of the world ocean by 2012. Well, we'll have it by 2082. at the present rate of growth. In Canada, the rate of growth is probably less. We have essentially no marine protected area to speak of, and therefore takes 20 years to declare one.
The really crazy thing, governments who should be acting to preserve ocean food stocks are actually paying more people to go out and destroy it. While dead and dying fisheries would be totally uneconomic, nobody can make a living from such thin catches, the boats keep on coming due to billions of dollars in government subsidies to the fishing industry and fish boat owners. Over $34 billion a year in subsidies.
I want to talk about subsidies to fisheries. Now, subsidy to fisheries is the reason why a fishery can continue to operate even though the fish are depleted. Normally, when you go out fishing, you catch the fish because they're abundant, enough to pay for your fuel, to repay the bank, to make your bank payment for the boat, for the loan for the boat, and to have a salary and so on, pay the crew, and the rest is profit and so on, you're happy. But if the fish are depleted, you don't break even. So if things go okay, you will not fish in areas that are depleted. So the fishery would self-stabilize. And I actually learned that when I was going to school. We cannot biologically overfish a stock because we cannot commercially overfish it. When we have commercially overfished it, then the fishery will relax, will go somewhere else. Well, if we subsidize the skipper by buying him a boat, making the fuel cheaper, getting a guaranteed loan that you don't have to really repay, then subsidies, you can actually continue to fish even though the stock is overfished. And the bank, forget about this big black thing here. The bank, the World Bank, was using a figure of about $20 billion for the subsidies given worldwide to the fishery. And we again put a student to the task, actually two or three, and what we got is $34 billion a year given worldwide to fisheries by governments, and we forget about that figure. And we estimated that this is about 40% of the value of the catch that is landed globally. So subsidies are so enormous that the fisheries throughout the world don't need to respond to the depletion that they cause. And when they continue fishing, they catch even less, and they have to have more subsidies. When the price of fuel goes up, they have to have more subsidies. All the things that should be feedback loops that should cause the fishery to fold because it doesn't work are overcome with subsidies, and that is you and me. Our tax money is paying for that.
It gets stranger. When some European governments agreed to buy out old boats to reduce excess capacity, owners used that promise to go to the bank, to get loans, to buy brand new, even larger trawlers. The biggest subsidizers are the Asian governments, followed by European ones. Strangely, the United States is on the right side of this issue. The U.S. doesn't offer big subsidies to ocean farmers as it does to land-based agriculture. America has called for an end to fishing subsidies in the World Trade Organization. Part of the answer, beyond ending deadly subsidies, is to move towards small-scale fishing again.
There are basically two kinds of fisheries, right? There are small-scale fisheries. They can be miserable like that. And there are high-tech fisheries. They can be like an airplane or a Starship Enterprise with electronic. And these fisheries compete. They compete sometimes in the same place for the same thing. And this comparison of the two types of fisheries is interesting. because, and I'm almost finished, because small-scale fisheries employ lots of people. They, in terms of the fish, the land that is used for human consumption, they catch almost the same thing. But the jobs that can be created with $1 per dollar are much more. In other words, they require far less money or investments. They produce no fish for reduction, fish meal, and have a much lower fuel consumption. How come our government do not help those? Because those have CEOs that play golf. Those guys don't play golf. They don't get to meet the minister and talk about the subsidies they're gonna get or not gonna get. I hope there's no minister here. Anyway, in other words, lots of the things we want to do, from conservation to job employment and so on, can be done by small-scale fisheries, by helping small-scale fisheries. And that's as true in developed countries as it is in developing countries. For example, there is one Scandinavian country, I think it's Denmark, which simply does not allow boats to go without the owner on board. Owner-operated boats. And that guarantees that people are involved in the fishery. When the fishery is only a big enterprise, you can get a complete neglect of the environmental setting and of the social setting.
But Dr. Pauly says aquaculture is not the answer. It cannot replace declining fish stocks, and aquaculture as understood by North Americans and Europeans, that is, fish farms raising salmon or trout, are terminally wasteful of ocean resources. Our style of aquaculture takes large amounts of perfectly edible small fish and concentrates them in high-value fish like salmon.
There are people who believe that aquaculture is the solution to all of this problem. And the growth of aquaculture, it grows very fast, aquaculture, and it's a solution to the problem. But first of all, most aquaculture, 2/3 of the world aquaculture is in China. This is very strange. 2/3 of the world aquaculture production is in China. And now I've read in Sofia, in a state of the world fisheries, that they're actually beginning at FAO to doubt that China has this monster aquaculture. The second thing is the fish that are grown by China is mainly mollusks and cyprinids, carp-like animals. That is, they don't have to feed them, because the salmon, when we talk aquaculture here, we actually mean salmon. In Europe, they would mean salmon and bass and so on, fish that are carnivores that must be fed with fish meal. And when we talk about aquaculture helping produce, helping feed the world, this is true for mollusks and cyprinid. They can be added to the world catch, the world marine catch. But if you're talking salmon, they cannot be added to the world catch, because the part of the world catch is needed to produce salmon. And more precisely, a huge amount is needed. This much is needed, is right now used for growing animals, is wasted on pigs, is wasted on chicken, on salmon. And I will explain why I say wasted. I would not have 1 month ago, 2 months ago, but I now think it's wasted. Now, you can say, I say wasted because for pigs and chicken, you can give them other feed. And I say wasted on salmon, because salmon, if you eat them for the taste, or if you eat them for the omega-3 fatty acid, you would get as much of a taste and far more omega-3 fatty acid if you ate the feed directly. And now I'm not going to show you the feed. That is salmon food. That is what I ate in Peru in an initiative that began by a friend there that the week of Anchoveta, where for the first time people have been convinced to try to eat Anchoveta as opposed to put them in a grinding them up. And she got even the President of the Republic to eat them on TV in his palace. And there is a sea change in the perception. All of a sudden, people realize that they have been wasting this resource, because it's wasted when it's fed to a salmon, because it can be eaten right there. Now, you Canadian, you think, I'm not going to eat this fish. Well, you are actually eating crab with a K, surimi. You're eating all kind of crap, actually, that is made from scrapes of fish and stuff. We're already eating that stuff. It's far worse than eating this. The Spaniards, the Italian, who know something about fish, they love this fish, and they will buy them. And that, hopefully, will be competition for the fish meal industry. And I hope it will go broke. And if it does, there will be no more salmon. You will have to eat this. But they are good, I'm telling you. Here, look at this, sushis, anchoveta sushis, and so on. Very nice. So if you ask me, what can I eat? I say anchoveta. And if you don't have any, import them. Why not?
I'll give you the conclusion to this speech by Dr. Daniel Pauly on March 10th, 2007. But don't go away. As often happens, important answers come when the public gets a chance to question the scientist. We even find out the worry that makes a would-be optimist like Pauly admit a fear of ultimate ocean extinctions. Here is the wrap-up, your call to action.
Gloom is justified. I looked at what the definition is for gloom, and we're certainly in a situation where gloom is appropriate, because this is really serious. Now, doom is a judgment. The judgment is made, and you are condemned to whatever, burning in hell and stuff. And we never have that, because we always, as long as we are alive, as long as there is life in the ocean, there are options. And we should pick up these options and make something, make the best of it. So doom not, but gloom, yes, because this is serious. And this is just a part of the environmental mess that we are causing, and that manifests itself, obviously, in global warming. That's a big problem, and that's also a gloom problem, not a doom problem, really. So what can you do? Well, you can eat the right fish and enjoy them, because some of them are really tasty, but don't think that's all you can do. That's not right. You have to write to your MLA and give them hell. What we need to do is to actually give them hell. And you can actually support an environmental NGO. The David Suzuki Foundation, if you want to go local, there is WWF, and so on. These are good people, and they fight on your behalf. So you can give them money, or you can become a member at large and help them out. And that's it. Good night.
Make and break and make do, but the fish are so few.
The first question is this.
Would the trawl fishery be banned, and with what would it be replaced?
I think that trawling will actually eventually be banned and recognized as destructive gear that it is. This will be made easy by the economics of trawling. Trawling is extremely energy intensive. And we can show, for example, Rashid and has recently, with Shumala here, has recently shown that deep sea fisheries are so dependent on subsidies that because they use so much energy, that if they didn't get it, they would not be profitable. So that's one thing. The other thing is that more and more areas without trawling are being declared. are being closer to trawling, much more than marine protected areas. Marine protected areas is areas where no fishing whatsoever is allowed in principle. And such things don't grow fast, I've shown you that. But areas without trawling, where no trawling is permitted, are growing very rapidly. And for example, all deep water, 6,000 or more than 500 meters or 300 in the Mediterranean is close to trawling. All areas in the Pacific that belong to the USA is close to trawling and so on. So trawling is maybe on its way out. We think historically, within 10, 20 years.
Replaced by?
Most of the fish that we exploit in trawls have a coastal manifestation. For example, cod, at least when they are abundant, occur in depth and in shallow water. You can, if you fish them in shallow water, as I presented at the beginning of my presentation, if you fish them in shallow water only, it's cheaper. You get a good product because you use lines and traps. In other words, it's all mashed up in the net. And the large female that produce all the eggs and all the recruitment are protected by depth. So this is why this fishery in Canada could go so long. And the trawlers destroyed that fishery by going where it, at depth where these large females were. So basically, we can, with gear such as traps and long lines, deep set long lines and so on, we can do the same thing, and gill nets. We can essentially do the same thing as trawlers. Also, you have to realize that with trawlers, we move something against the fish. And in an energy scarce world, you will want to use the energy that the fish have to catch themselves. In other words, they move.
Finally, we arrive at the Castle of Doom. A member of the audience asks why Dr. Pauly has not mentioned the problem of our carbon emissions dropping into the ocean to make it more acidic. And here is his reply.
Yeah, because I would have switched over to doom and gloom.
Ocean acidification was the question.
This ocean acidification problem, you understand what it is. If you put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide will go in the water. Presently, a figure you will remember, 1 million ton per hour of carbon dioxide goes from the atmosphere in the water. 1 million ton per hour. It's a nice number. It will be true for the next 10 years, approximately. Then it will be 2 million ton per hour. Anyway, that's how much. And then if you put carbon dioxide in water, what you get is carbonic acid, dilute carbonic acid, right? You can take a Coke, since you don't want to drink that stuff, put a bone in it, and it will be dissolved in a week or so. This is a weak acid, carbonic. So we are acidifying the ocean. That's happening. And I was at AAAS, that is the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a few weeks ago in San Francisco. And essentially, the ocean will cease to harbor life in 100 years. But you don't want to hear that on a Saturday evening. And that will be due to the tar sand in Alberta. There is a very convincing argument was made that all massive extinction on Earth, the five big extinctions on the Permian and so on, including the one that hit us in 65 million years ago that ended up the dinosaurs and stuff, was followed by the disappearance of a massive part of the oceanic fauna and flora. And the author attributed to not temperature, not the nuclear winter, because of the sun light not reaching the Earth and so on, because of the dust in the atmosphere and so on, but acidification that followed. For example, after the event 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaur. This was due to a big meteor hitting the Yucatan Peninsula. And those of you who have spent vacation there will know that the soil is caustic. It is calcium carbonate, really old reef. And all of this was sent up in the atmosphere, which was then sulfuric acid rain for probably centuries. And that wiped out lots of marine life. And we will have conditions similar to that in about 100 years. So, yeah, if I talked about that, I shouldn't, because I'm not a chemist and I don't work on that. But I understand what it is. And this is the end of life as we know it. 100 years, so it will be your grandchildren. Don't bother.
That is where we leave Dr. Daniel Pauly, and our thanks to him and the Vancouver Institute for allowing this important speech to be recorded. You can download the whole one-hour lecture, plus the question and answer period, free from our website at www.ecoshock.org. Look for Oceans in the Audio On Demand menu. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Learn more about Dr. Pauly's work. His ocean modeling system is called EcoPath. See www.ecopath.org. The online encyclopedia of fish types he helped establish is FishBase at fishbase.org. And the global mapping of fisheries trends is available at www.searoundus.org. That's searoundus.org.
What has accelerated is that it's many more people who depend on wild resources like fish and seafood, but also the industrial scale at which we're scooping up species from the ocean, the global scale at which we're operating now. There's no ocean region that is exempt from our impacts. Only 1% of the ocean or less is protected effectively from fishing. The consequences are manifold. What we show is that whenever you lose ocean species, you lose productivity and stability of the ocean ecosystem. This means the ocean is less able to produce seafood, to produce and deliver clean water, and to recover from stresses and perturbations such as climate change. It means the ocean ecosystem is becoming more fragile, less reliable, more brittle over time.
I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for tuning in. You can reach us at radio@ecoshock.org. Keep your ears out for the next part of our series, Acid Ocean Meltdown.
But who knows what's going to happen here? How long we'll be able to hold on?